including the Center for Constitutional Rights, which did so much incredible legal work on human rights and on trying to hold the U.S. government accountable for the atrocities that it committed around the world. There's not enough words to describe how important Peter was to the progressive movement, to human rights over these last decades, since the late 50s, early 1960s. And it's sad to say goodbye to him, but we all continue to be inspired and guided by every good deed that he did over his entire life.
Peter Kornbluh, I want to thank you for being with us, senior analyst at the National Security Archive. We'll link to your pieces in Foreign Policy and The Nation. That does it for our show. I'll be at the St. Louis International Film Festival tonight for two screenings of Steal This Story, Please, a documentary about Democracy Now. I'll be 7:30 at B&B Theaters in Creve Coeur, West Olive, 10 and Bowling, and at 9 o'clock, the second showing of Steal This Story, Please, at MX Movies and Bar. You can check out information, learn about tickets by going to democracynow.org under Speaking Events. We'll be doing the Q&A with one of the directors of the film. Happy early birthday to Diana Parra and Jenny Keenan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
There was heaven and there was earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con Annie.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, SNAP payments in Oregon get fully funded.
The City of Portland enforces camping restrictions.
And Oregon Congresswoman Janelle Bynum calls for Oregon to fund the TSA and air traffic controllers' salaries at PDX.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 7, 2025. I'm John Nelson.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Oregonians who have been waiting on their SNAP benefits woke up to their Oregon Trail cards flush once again. Last night, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek and the Oregon Department of Human Services, or ODHS, issued full SNAP benefits following a federal judge's order in Rhode Island. The fate of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, has been uncertain since it needs to be funded by Congress, which has shut down the government because they can't come to a deal on a continuing budget resolution. Oregon SNAP recipients now have funds on their Oregon Trail cards available for immediate use. State teams reportedly worked through the night to ensure folks who use SNAP benefits would not go hungry this weekend. The Trump administration is appealing the judge's ruling, attempting to further stall the food support that American residents rely on. One in six Oregonians rely on SNAP to buy food every month. Last year, around $133 million went out to Oregonians each month as part of the program. That's roughly $4.3 million a day. Oregon ranks among the top states for utilizing SNAP. That's because a decade ago, lawmakers and advocates made a serious anti-hunger push, teaching nonprofits and other partners how to help people apply for benefits. SNAP is also a big boost for local economies. For every $1 in SNAP money spent in Oregon, $1.50 in economic activity is generated.
It's been a week since Portland started enforcing its new camping ban. Over 40 people have been arrested in connection to the new enforcement. The policy was adopted last year, but not enforced until now. People are prohibited from tent camping or staying in a vehicle on public property, including sidewalks, parks, and streets, if, quote, reasonable shelter is available. Those breaking the law can be fined $100 or spend a week in jail. Enforcement began on November 1st. In the first 5 days of enforcement, officers issued 7 citations for the camping ban itself. Officers also arrested 39 people for outstanding warrants while going through camps to warn people about the new policy. They also warned some 80 people about violating the camping ban, but did not fine or jail them. It is not clear why some people were issued a warning and others were cited. Portland Mayor Keith Wilson directed police to begin enforcing the rule because there appeared to be some vacancies in the city's nighttime-only shelters. In all, officials visited 57 Portland campsites. 39 people living outside agreed to move into an overnight shelter when confronted. Wilson said in a statement, quote, "We're leading with compassion in life-saving shelter and focusing on the safety, sanitation, and accessibility of our public spaces," end quote. Portland City Council will consider cutting over $4 million from the homeless sweep budget and move it towards housing, food assistance, and support for immigrants. Councilor Angelita Murillo put the proposal forward, and City Council is expected to discuss it at their meeting on November 12th.
As Portland International Airport and 39 other airports nationwide face a 10% reduction, airlines have canceled hundreds of flights to comply with the Federal Aviation Administration's order. The FAA says the reduction is necessary to keep the airspace safe as it deals with persistent staffing shortages among air traffic controllers who are currently working without pay due to the federal government shutdown. Those controllers are required to work without pay until the shutdown ends, and they are under growing pressure as they face the prospect of missing a second paycheck. Critics of the Trump administration believe this move is about more than just safety. U.S. Representative Steve Cohen, a Democrat from Tennessee, told NPR, quote, "This is a political move by the Trump administration to try to force Democrats to accede to their budget and priorities, which cut health care and nutrition benefits from seniors, children, and people with disabilities," end quote. Despite his political disagreements, Senator Cohen called the move prudent, given the added stress on the nation's air traffic controllers due to the shutdown. Oregon Congresswoman Janelle Bynum asked the state of Oregon to pay Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, officers and air traffic controllers before the reduction in flight capacity. Bynum blamed Republicans for the shutdown. If the state of Oregon were to pay these critical employees, it would allow PDX to request a waiver to roll back the reduction of flight capacity and continue operations as normal. The city of Denver, Colorado, and the state of Hawaii will join Portland in this approach to avoid delays. Bynum says, quote, "PDX plays a critical role in our economy and serves as a gateway to the rest of the country for Oregonians. That's why I'm calling on our state to immediately fund salaries of our essential airport safety and security workers. Oregonians and airport workers alike shouldn't be forced to face the consequences of Republican politicians' inability to fund the government," end quote.
Lawyers at the Oregon Law Center say Multnomah County Jail is violating Oregon's Sanctuary Promise Law by letting U.S. Marshals hold ICE detainees there. The people held in custody are typically waiting transfer for deportation proceedings. The Oregon Law Center attorneys say at least three people are held in the Multnomah County jails on a single charge of illegal reentry or because they were subject to an immigration detainer. A detainer is a non-binding request from ICE to hold an unlawful resident until the agency can take custody. Oregon Live learned about the claim through a public records request earlier this month. Multnomah County was sued earlier in the year on behalf of Garrison Molina Orantes on a money laundering bust and charged with illegal reentry. Oregon's U.S. District Judge Amy Baguio ordered his release while the case was pending April 28th. Rather than follow Judge Baguio's order, federal marshals transferred Orantes back to the Multnomah County Jail. Orantes was ultimately transported to the ICE field office in Portland's South Waterfront neighborhood. Oregon Law Center attorney Mary Ruth Petzing said, quote, "The legalese in this case is complex, but the basic idea is simple. When somebody is free to go, they should be free to go," end quote. U.S. Marshals have agreed at other jails in Oregon, including Columbia County Sheriff's Office and the Northern Oregon Regional Correctional Facilities in the Dalles. The contracts pay local jails a daily fee per inmate. Under Oregon's Sanctuary Promise Act, local law enforcement officials are not permitted to assist ICE unless ordered by a judge.
City Council canceled its scheduled meeting this week so council members wouldn't cross a picket line. 11 unionized staff members at Portland's Independent Police Review, or IPR, are on strike after their contract negotiations with the city broke down. Earlier this week, they camped on the sidewalk in front of City Hall in the face of wind and heavy rain. Their office is set to be dissolved when the voter-approved Office of Community-Based Police Accountability, or CBPA, takes up its work next year. IPR staff hope to be absorbed into the new office, but that's not been guaranteed. City Councilor Eric Zimmerman led the efforts to help IPR staffers keep their jobs. He twice asked councilors to sign on to his proposal to add a resolution to the council agenda to offer the workers an on-ramp into the new office. The City of Portland has refused to guarantee IPR workers a position in the new police oversight board. City of Portland spokesperson Allison Perkins says, quote, "Guaranteeing direct placement would violate city charter," end quote, because it would override the director's hiring authority. The Striking Workers Local Union, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME, disagrees, writing in a Tuesday press release, quote, "Workers are going on strike due to the City of Portland's outright refusal to offer positions doing the same or similar work in the new police oversight board to these experienced public servants," end quote.
The Portland Parks levy passed to continue funding for the next 5 years on Tuesday. The measure passed with a 55% approval rating. The levy will raise over $450 million over the next 5 years. This will go to funding programs and classes to parks for all Portlanders, as well as ensuring the conservation of park ecosystems in the face of a changing climate. The levy was criticized for not addressing the pressing maintenance backlog. Bird Alliance of Oregon said in a statement, quote, "This is only a temporary solution to a systemic problem. We urge the Portland City Council to continue to engage with parks leadership and community partners to chart a pathway to a sustainable and equitable long-term funding solution," end quote. This measure will cost property owners $1.40 to $1,000 worth of property value. City Councilor Dan Ryan came out against the levy last minute. He said in his recent newsletter, quote, "Parks needs a shakeup, and a no vote is what is necessary to wake us up and deliver reforms," end quote. He believes the Park Department isn't fully maximizing available funds and should pursue public-private partnerships instead. He adds on that the Parks Department needs to tweak their current activity discount to ensure those who truly need help can access it. A community oversight committee will be appointed soon with the goal to review expenditures, data, and performance metrics, as well as report annually to the City Council. The measure will ensure Portlanders will continue being able to access and appreciate Portland's many parks.
In national news, Nancy Pelosi won't seek re-election. Flyers begin to feel the pinch from the government shutdown. Anti-ICE organizers encourage lawful resistance. and postal workers aim to rally local governments in support of the U.S. Postal Service. With those stories and more, it's Zamon Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Nancy D'Alessandro Pelosi will go down in history as the greatest speaker of all time. Her tenure has been iconic, legendary, historic, and transformational.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is praising Nancy Pelosi, who won't seek re-election to her San Francisco district. Pelosi was the first ever woman speaker and was key to passing the Affordable Care Act. She tapped Jeffries to replace her at the top of House Democrats as the party's base pressed for younger leadership. Pelosi is 85. Centrist Maine Democratic Congressman Jared Golden says he's also retiring. President Donald Trump won his district, so it could become a target for the GOP. And close Trump ally Republican Representative Elise Stefanik says she will run for governor of New York. The FAA is allowing 10% fewer flights at major airports as unpaid air traffic controllers call in sick to already understaffed towers. Senate Majority Leader John Thune blames Democrats for impacts from the shutdown.
That means widespread flight cancellations, supply chain issues, hundreds of thousands of passengers dealing with disruptions to travel every day. The impact this will be immense.
A D.C. jury has acquitted a man charged with throwing a sub sandwich at a federal immigration officer. The White House says harsh enforcement against protests is justified to maintain order. But Ido Osigbovo with the Chicago Black Voter Project says everyone in that city, no matter their ethnicity, should see the need for solidarity and lawful resistance to ICE.
It's common to assume that only folks of a certain demographic are impacted, but Chicago's always been an interconnected city. So we're talking about people who share space, whether that's living space or their kids go to school together.
Postal workers across the country are encouraging municipal and county governments to come out against privatizing the USPS, something the administration may be considering. Angela Lish, an Ohio retiree active with the American Postal Workers Union, says privatization could mean the end of universal service, which would be terrible for seniors and rural residents.
Everybody should care. You know, it goes from the customers to the employees, even out of our country. Because right now we are regulated. If it's privatized, they can pretty much do what they want to do.
The American Postal Workers Union says the Postal Service doesn't get tax money and provides about 7 million jobs nationwide. Clean energy advocates are celebrating the election of Abigail Spanberger in Virginia and Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, saying the new governors will be good news for consumers and the environment. David Kiva, with the Environmental Defense Action Fund, says they can counterbalance efforts by Trump to scale back renewable projects and encourage fossil fuels.
He's been working as hard as he possibly can to snuff out investments in clean energy just because he doesn't like windmills or solar panels. And that's hurting the American people and causing all of our bills to go up.
I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6:30, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, expect cloudy conditions and light winds overnight with a low temperature of 46 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be much the same, clouds with a high of 62. On this day in history, November 7th, 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution swept through Russia as Vladimir Lenin's forces overthrew the Russian monarchy and established a provisional government. The revolution was fueled by public discontent over economic hardship, food shortages, and military failures during World War I. The quote of the day is from Russian writer Leo Tolstoy, who said, quote, "The two most powerful warriors are patience and time."
The mother of an Apache 16-year-old who's been missing since last month says her child's remains were discovered by tribal and federal police earlier this week. With that story and more, it's Gabriel Pietrorazio with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The mother of an Apache 16-year-old who's been missing since last month says her child's remains were discovered by tribal and federal police earlier this week. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it comes after the state recently named a new alert system in honor of another Apache teen, Emily Pike.
Chalistia Coloway, who went by Tia, disappeared in mid-October. No turquoise alert had been issued. But on Monday, authorities found human remains in Navajo County near the Knott's Landing community in White River on the Fort Apache Reservation. Authorities asked for help in trying to identify the body by releasing physical and clothing descriptions. Soon after, Tia's biological mother confirmed on social media that her daughter was found. The investigation is being handled by the White Mountain Apache Police Department and BIA Fort Apache Agency. The Bureau of Indian Affairs Missing and Murdered Unit is also involved. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
It's not easy for a school to take in 70 students at once, but a school in Anchorage has done just that. It's opened its Yupik Language Immersion Program to children whose families were forced to move to the city after hurricane-force winds and floods devastated coastal villages in western Alaska last month. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride tells us, the school feels warm and welcome to the students.
Morning.
Hello.
The day at College Gate starts just as it did back home, with the Pledge of Allegiance.
Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Recited in the Yupik language, or Yuktun. When College Gate began its Yupik immersion program 8 years ago, it had just one kindergarten class and added a new grade every year. Now, it's a tight-knit family that just got bigger. The new students play hard at recess. The school's daily routine seems to help them feel more grounded, something that's hard to do when you've lost everything.
I just felt like my house moved to the ocean.
Eileen Aliagorea says she feels safer since she moved to Anchorage. She and her family were inside their home when the flood carried it off.
The house spinned really fast, and we were like going down to the river, and then we stopped. We hit something really hard 2 times, and my living room window broke.
It's a nightmare that Aline says her new friends at the school are helping her to forget. Friends like Lily Lowen.
After something so big happening, they're still so, like, cheerful, and they're so friendly, and they were just so fun to be around, and I'm really glad they are here.
Lily says this experience has been an opportunity to learn about something larger than yourself.
It makes me feel like I could be doing more to help, even though I'm a kid.
But simply being a kid may be a bigger help than Lily realizes. To share jokes and play games like Boop.
No, she got you that time.
In Boop, you tag people on the nose, and then they're it. Add some pig snorts, and you get a real giggle fest going. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Data show math and English test scores for middle school students throughout New England remain below pre-pandemic levels, although some more affluent districts have seen improvement. Educators say there's no one-size-fits-all solution, but increasing both instructional time and the number of standardized testing days could help. Catherine Carley has more on the story.
Middle school educators throughout New England are working to raise students' test scores, but experts warn there's no one-size-fits-all solution. Student performance in math and English remains below pre-pandemic levels, although some more affluent districts have seen improvement. Katie Powell with the Association for Middle Level Education says standardized test results arrive after students have already moved on to the next grade. She says conducting benchmark assessments throughout the year lowers the pressure and gives teachers real-time, actionable data to better help individual students learn.
While we still have students and have something we can do with them, we can react to the data we're getting. We can respond to it and make thoughtful decisions.
Educators say students can benefit from the added familiarity with the test and see how questions are generally presented before a final end-of-year exam. Still, Powell notes it's important districts audit how often assessments are given and whether they're developmentally appropriate for the middle school mind, which is still undergoing rapid development. Some districts have adopted new English and math curricula in recent years and are already seeing improvements in test scores. Some schools have chosen to increase the amount of time students spend on those subjects and are also seeing positive results. Powell points to Woodstock Union Middle School in Vermont as one school that's getting it right, ensuring teachers get the professional development they need to learn new material and meet students where they're at.
They gave time for their staff to study those practices, to talk together about what it would look like to implement more developmentally responsive practices in those areas, and then implement it.
Schools are also working to ensure students show up to school enough to help close performance gaps. Rhode Island has begun recognizing schools like G'day Learning Academy in Middletown, which has both reduced chronic absenteeism and improved test scores by 5 percentage points. Powell says the middle grades are an optimum time for learning, but that schools need agency to find solutions that work best for their own communities. This story is based on original reporting from Samantha Kamir with Chalkbeat. I'm Catherine Carley for New England News Service.
Just a few years ago at Portland's Jefferson High School, an after-school drama program didn't exist. But impassioned students and staff have worked together to grow a program, including putting on their first musical in 20 years last spring. Now, the growing theater program is tackling a new challenge this weekend. 2 plays for the price of 1. KBOO's Althea Billings has more on the double feature performance.
Coming up this weekend, students in the theater program at Portland's Jefferson High School are putting on a double feature of 2 original plays, Upon the Heath and The King in Yellow. Talia Pratt is a senior at Jefferson. She says each play has a psychological element, and one reimagines Shakespeare.
Upon the Heath is a sort of retelling of the play Macbeth. It's essentially from the perspective of 3 witches that tell Macbeth of his fate and are actively trying to change his fate. The King in Yellow is a story about a very wild man who believes that the script that he's written out is sort of a premonition of the future and that the kingdom of America is destined to be his. These are definitely more unique, especially because they've been written by our director. So they're definitely more personalized for our program. They're more designed to explore the psyches and like mindsets that these characters go through. They're more character driven and explores their mental state and their mindset when strange and crazy things happen to them.
Pratt has a role in each of the plays of the double feature. The theater program at Jefferson High School has been growing over the past few years. In the spring, they reached a notable milestone, their first musical production in 20 years. Stage manager and junior Tabitha Shea says they've worked hard to grow the program.
Jefferson High School, for a while, we didn't have a theater program because we didn't have it in our budget to have one. Us being a mostly Black student school, we're not given a lot of budget, especially being in the arts. And up until the last few years, we just didn't have one. And Daniel Coffey, who's our director, he is also an English teacher. He took up the job opportunity to become the theater director. And he has been directing plays ever since then. Yeah, it's been really great. But we haven't, for 20 years, we didn't have any plays. We didn't have any musicals because our school simply couldn't offer the opportunity.
Pratt wasn't drawn to the theater program initially. She says she was recruited to be a part of it. Now, it's become a big part of who she is and where she wants to go.
It's like, it made me realize how much I actually enjoyed doing theater, that I want to continue to do that. I'm trying to go to college for theater, musical theater, and acting.
The Jefferson High School Theater Program's double feature of 2 original plays, Upon the Heath and The King in Yellow, debuts Friday, November 7th at 7 p.m., and runs through the next two weekends, closing on Saturday, November 15th. More information can be found on their Instagram profile at Jefferson_theater or on the Jefferson High School website. For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
Insurance companies turn to reinsurance companies when they have to pay out many claims at once, like after a hurricane or other disaster. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. After a wildfire or hurricane, insurance companies may be flooded with claims from homeowners.
These types of events can impact thousands of insurance policyholders simultaneously. And that, because of the large-scale nature of them, put an insurance company at risk of insolvency.
Michael Quigley is with Munich Re, a company that offers what's known as reinsurance. Reinsurance is insurance for insurance companies and helps them stay afloat if a major disaster forces them to pay out many claims at once.
Just as you or I would purchase homeowners insurance to protect against catastrophic fire or natural disaster that could destroy our home, so too does an insurance company protect itself against such severe catastrophic events.
But climate change is making fires and hurricanes more destructive, which puts more pressure on reinsurance companies. In response, some are raising their rates. So to help control costs and keep people safe, Quigley stresses the importance of making homes more resilient to disasters.
We need to focus on implementing prevention measures like better building codes and land use planning to lower those losses and to keep insurance premiums more affordable.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, November 7th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, Althea Billings, John Nelson, Dave Johnson, and Lizard. The co-producers for the newscast are Althea Billings and Dave Johnson. Our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Simone Perez, Gabriel Pietro-Razio, Kathy